I will now call the second case set for oral argument today. That case is number 824-2001, Troy Olds versus City of Morehead. I believe that council are familiar with our standard procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. As you may know, our lectern is adjustable. There are two buttons on the front that will raise it up and down for you if you wish. Counsel for appellant, you may approach, and please begin by identifying yourself and your clients, and then you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Celeste Culberth, and I represent the appellant, Troy Olds. Today we ask this court to reverse the district court's order granting summary judgment. The district court found that Olds established a causal connection in his whistleblower prima facie case. Using the McDonnell-Douglas analysis, the district court then made factual findings and drew inferences not allowed at summary judgment. For example, the district court found Olds engaged in an angry tirade despite its own acknowledgement that the fact was in dispute and that, quote, all accounts except Mr. Olds supported this story.
Well, I know you're just starting, and I'm sorry to interrupt. I thought the only point that was in disagreement about the argument was whether the door or whether the passage was blocked by Mr. Olds. I thought that was the only point in dispute.
No, Your Honor, there were a number of points in dispute. So, for example, the part of this tirade was whether or not it was an angry tirade. And Mr. Olds said that he was not displaying anger.
I understand the characterization of it. Okay, I understand.
Right. That there was some cussing that was involved. But what Mr. Olds was saying was that his boss had in fact engaged in an angry tirade towards him and had told him that he hated his effing job because of Mr. Olds.
Not on that occasion. That was a different point.
If I understand your question, Your Honor, was Mr. Austin in that conversation? No. What he was relaying to Mr.
Right,
Lexon
but I
was
talking about I think it was February 20th when the two Mr. Olds and Mr. Lexon were in the room together.
Right.
So within that context, the disagreement is to the characterization of the exchange. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that what happened in that exchange was not an angry tirade at all. That what happened in that exchange was a conversation that was an invited conversation.
I understand that it was not. Mr. Olds' deposition, though, that he acknowledged that he raised his voice and then indicated he has does that on occasion, circumstances that it's hard for him to control that.
I believe his testimony was that he raised his voice and that Mr. Lexon also had raised voices, but that the raised voices were not unusual, that there had been conversations between Mr. Lexon and Mr. Olds previously that had also had raised voices, but no consequence and no issue with respect that there were raised voices.
So when I was reading counsel about the raised voices,
yes,
there seemed to be, both sides seemed to, you know, cite different parts of the record. One is we have the deposition. And I might be wrong, I don't know that in the deposition, Mr. Olds testified that he raised his voice and that Lexon raised his voice. I know that there's like reports, the report that draws on a report, summary report of an interview. You know, we get like sort of like that.
Exactly.
And then there's also an email. I don't know, is it undisputed that Mr. Lexon raised his voice? You seem to be saying today it is, that it's undisputed that Lexon raised his voice and that Olds raised his voice. Is that true during the February 20th dispute?
I don't know if Mr. Lexon testified about whether or not he raised his voice, but for the purposes of summary judgment, Mr. Olds said that he raised his voice. And I think that's sufficient to say that both of them raised their voices.
Okay, so it's undisputed that voices were raised on February 20th into two participants. You're not disputing that.
True.
Okay. And is it also undisputed? I know that there's reference to, you know, an email that suggests, I was trying to trace where these things are and frankly having a little difficulty about the, you know, an impairment or some disability that makes it impossible for Mr. Olds to control his volume, et cetera. Is that undisputed?
I don't believe anyone disputes that Mr. Olds suffers from anxiety disorder and depression.
And is it undisputed that his behavior as a result is that he is... What's undisputed about his behavior as a result of that? Is it undisputed that he can't control his volume, that he doesn't control, his volume is uncontrolled?
I don't think there's that kind of evidence in the record.
Okay. So what is it about, if in fact, about the 220 interaction between the two, the dispute about it is not that voices were not raised, including Mr. Olds. Mr. Olds, it's undisputed that he raised his voice. What is disputed about that if the reason for the termination is his conduct during that event? What is disputed about it?
Sure. So one of the things that is disputed is, again, the barricading. He didn't barricade anyone. Another dispute about this is that when Mr. Olds was speaking with him that it was something that was out of the ordinary. He disputes that Mr. Lexon, had shown him any fear. He saw this conversation as a conversation not unlike other conversations that he had had.
Is it disputed that others heard it?
Some others heard it, but Some people testified that they heard it. Mm-hmm. But when Mr. Olds left the office, he talked to people who were right outside of the office, and they said they didn't hear it.
Is it disputed that the people who said they heard it actually in fact heard it? I guess.
Well, I think the circumstantial evidence is if you've got people who are right next to the office say they didn't hear it, and then people who are further down the office say they did hear it, then there's a dispute as to really how loud it was and whether those people actually heard it. I think credibility determination.
And again, all this stuff, I mean, obviously at summary judgment has to be on admissible evidence, so I'm trying to understand this. So the dispute about whether people heard it is his testimony that he spoke with people that told him that they did not hear it, not testimony from others that they did not hear it. I'm trying to understand the record.
Yes, that's right. Okay. So it's his testimony that when, and this would come in, I assume, under a present sense impression, did you hear this? No.
Okay.
That information would come in. Others in the office told him that they didn't hear it.
Is there anything else that's disputed about that engagement on that date that we should think about? Because I have other questions beyond the two.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I think that it makes it sound like this is a conversation was uncommon in the workplace. It was not, and that B, that it's somehow unrelated to Olds making reports about being retaliated against and blowing the whistle. What he's relaying to Lexon is that he was retaliated against by Austin, and that he was retaliated against in the context of blowing the whistle. And so, you know, I think that to see this as some conversation that is completely unrelated to blowing the whistle does not take into account all of the facts and circumstances that were happening.
So your his testimony, I assume it's his testimony in which he says, during that meeting, I said that earlier Mr. Austin had said the following to me in response, in retaliation for my making a report, right?
Well, Mr. Lexon also talks about how he had told him that he was suffering reprisal at the hands of Austin. During that meeting.
Okay.
And Lexon confirms that he was saying, when you talked to Austin about the text that I sent you, he sat me down and berated me and told me that he hated his job because of me.
So that interaction with Austin, another argument that I think you make is that there was unequal treatment of similarly situated people, and I
right.
think you identify Mr. Austin's conduct as being
That's
unprofessional
right.
conduct that was not addressed by the employer.
That's right.
And so is it in the record, where is it in the record, that the employer knew at the time that Mr. Austin said, I don't care, I hate my job, and it's because of you.
Sure.
Excuse me. I don't hate my job, it's because of you. Okay.
Okay.
So was that reported at the time? Not 220, but at the time it occurred?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Olds reported to Human Resources that he believed that Lexon was asking him to work out of class, and the retaliatory incident by Austin for refusing to work out of class. So that is Olds' declaration, paragraph 64, docket 73, and also the Olds' deposition, page 157.
And he reported Austin's conduct, what
yes.
Austin did, the unprofessional conduct of saying those things.
He reported the conduct, and he reported that to the Human Resources professional. But he also reported being attacked in his job to...
I'm focused on the dissimilar treatment right now, not whether he made reports of wrongdoing, because it seems like that seems to be part of the prima facie case that's not really challenged that much now, that he made reports of protected activity of
mm-hmm.
reports. But the dissimilar treatment, you're saying it's in the record that he reported Mr. Austin's treatment and that Mr. Austin suffered no consequences.
Right.
Is that
it's
right?
at page 7 of our brief.
Okay.
And instead, the city sent Olds to non-disciplinary training. City did not send Austin to anger management classes. That goes on to page 8.
But wait, your client went to anger management, though, right?
Non-disciplinary anger management. Right. But there was not equal treatment to Austin, who engaged in an angry tirade.
So what are the other, so we've talked about, you know, a dispute about, or difference of accounts of what happened on that day. We talk about dissimilar treatment alleged but
mm-hmm.
for unprofessional conduct. What else would you cite as the key evidence that, in fact, this decision was motivated by his reports of wrongdoing, protected activity, as
sure.
opposed to the events of 220?
Okay. Sure. So first off, the district court found that it was motivated. And the district court found that the knowledge of the protected activity, followed closely in time by the retaliation, plus the significant amount of evidence destroyed, all established causation.
Right. Well, I don't think the district court is making findings because this is summary judgment. And so it's decided, right, it's not a factual finding, so it shouldn't be making factual findings. It's whether there's a genuine dispute, and it's saying that there's prima facie case is satisfied under the law, the prima facie case, not liability. Prima facie case is established by a report and temporal proximity. But then the question is, okay, is there enough evidence to show that the motivation... And you're saying the stipulation, that's the new thing I think you added in there, the stipulation.
Well, the court...
Not the stipulation, the spoliation. How does the
right.
spoliation factor into whether, when making the decision to terminate, Volkers was motivated by his protected activity?
Okay. So the court found more than temporal proximity in the prima facie case. So I just want to be clear about that. The court found more than that. The court found that the spoliation itself was also evidence. And the spoliation instruction that the court found in its order that it would proffer is that the jury may infer that the lost or deleted documents data which were under the exclusive control of defendant would have been favorable to plaintiff's claims and would have been unfavorable to defendant's defenses. And so the issue there is the defendants asked for summary judgment saying that there was no evidence of causation, and yet the very emails that would have established more evidence of causation were deleted by the defendant. All adverse inferences must be in the favor of the plaintiff.
But you are arguing that the district court had to draw an inference, I think probably from the deletion of Volker's email. Sounds
true.
Like
that, right? And Zimmerman's, right? Because there was no litigation hold on anyone's emails. And so if there was something that Zimmerman or Austin didn't want to have included, they could have deleted that and it was not preserved. Unless there's other questions, I see my time is
up. I understand the time has expired, but I think that if we have additional questions, I think we should ask them. Judge Smith, I do have some questions that I've been waiting to ask.
But, go ahead.
But I could, if
no,
you
no.
have more. And we will, of course, accord Respondents' Counsel the same opportunity if she is lucky enough to be bombarded with questions in the same manner. But bombarded is, I'm not being serious, of course. My question, I guess, has to do with, in Respondents' Brief at page 10 states that Volkers, the decision maker, was not aware of appellant's protected conduct between 2015 and 2020. Do you dispute that?
Yes.
Okay. And what evidence in the record contradicts that statement?
Well, the first one is the adverse inference. The judge found that that was not credible, that the knowledge of the other decision makers would be imputed to her. But if you look at also the Soldo investigative file.
Can you point me to The judge, I mean, can you be specific about where I could find that?
Yes. It's in a footnote.
Page 8?
Page 8.
Finding it now.
Yes. Yes. Court recognizes city claims that Volkers did not have knowledge. This argument is unpersuasive. Ignoring readily available information doesn't insulate the city from knowledge. Further, the court has previously found this significant amount of evidence was indeed destroyed. Taking both of these factors into consideration, the court finds that there is a causal connection.
And this is in the context of prima facie case, right? Setting aside
but
for a moment.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but the prima facie case are the elements of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act.
But isn't it true that establishing the third element of the prima facie case is not the same thing as proving retaliation at the third step of McDonnell Douglas or
I disagree.
At trial?
Okay. I disagree.
Okay, can you explain? And,
sure.
And if so, with reference to case law, if you could.
Sure. The elements of the claim are the reported conduct, the adverse action, and the causal connection. That is what's in the statute. That is what McGrath versus TCF says, is that all you have to show in order to prevail at trial is that there is evidence of a motivating factor. That is what needs to be proved. And so in the way that this court applied the McDonnell Douglas test, it had the plaintiff prove her case with a causal connection that went beyond temporal proximity, and then it weighed that against evidence of what the employer's reasoning was.
But isn't the burden at the prima facie case just simply to produce evidence that is capable of satisfying that element, not whether it's
yes, and that's exactly what Rule 56 commands. is that all you have to do is produce that evidence. If there is evidence weighing, if there's a burden of production and a burden of persuasion, we have gone beyond Rule 56.
Well, I'm going to focus on some other things right now. So on the footnote you just identified said, ignoring readily available information does not insulate the city from the knowledge. Can you tell us what evidence is being referenced there by the district court?
Well, I'm sure that there's evidence that was in the Soldo investigative file that included the reports that, you know, an email that Troy Olds had sent. There was complaints that Troy Olds made. There are complaints that Troy Olds made to Austin, to Human Resources, to Zimmerman, to Schultz, and that information, you could call it a cat's paw if you wanted to, but I think what the district court is saying is that information is imputed, and here's why. Because those folks are producing the data that is going to Volkers. And at that point, the district court finds knowledge is there.
I have two follow-up questions to that. One is, as a matter of law, has the cat's paw theory been recognized in Minnesota? I don't know. But when I read your reply brief, it came to mind, but there was no, you didn't use that term.
I don't think I used that phrase, but I know that I cited case law in the brief that talked about imputing knowledge, and if it wasn't, I'm not sure that I put it in my appellate brief because the judge found knowledge, but I'm sure it's in my summary judgment brief where I reference the case law that shows that knowledge should be imputed and that she knew. And the city, you know, the court found that they knew. That's one burden I don't have to go over. I have a number of burdens, but that one I don't.
I think one thing you argued in your reply brief is that Volkers relied upon, I think, three things or three other people. One was Soldo's investigative report. Secondly, I think oral input of Zimmerman, and three, HR.
Settergren.
Mm-hmm. I guess, so what evidence is there in the record that those people had a retaliatory animus?
Well, Settergren took the report about Olds, or when Olds was reporting Austin, and completely dismissed it. Settergren was told by Volkers to be careful with Olds' personal effects and to not pack it up unless Olds said, go ahead and pack it up. She failed to talk to Olds about packing it up, and it was destroyed. She talked about Zimmerman. There's animus that I show in my brief about how when Olds made a complaint about whistleblowing, that he and HR and others discussed that maybe he should be punished for making that complaint. And he also said that he thought that Troy Olds should be afraid to talk to him.
Zimmerman, and where is the evidence of that? What form does it take? Is it deposition? Is it the declaration?
Yeah, I will pull that up for you. That is under causation. Just a moment, I have it.
It's a big record.
What's that?
It's a big record.
I've got it. Okay. Okay, so we need to look at the February 14 Olds report to city engineer Zimmerman. That's court docket 82, Culberth Exhibit 63. The evidence that...
And it's a February 14th, 2020 what?
2020.
You said 2/14. I might have misheard.
February 14, 2020.
Okay.
Olds makes a report to Zimmerman about treatment and begs for his job.
He makes a report to Zimmerman about treatment of him. And that is evidence of, how does that relate to,
Well, he talks about making reports that are
protected
conduct.
There's a difference between reports of treatment and reports of wrongdoing, whistleblowing. Are you talking about reports?
Well, I'm saying those are both, though, coextensive, because reports of being retaliated against for making reports are violations of the Whistleblower Act, and that is protected conduct. So his reports of ill treatment are whistleblower reports.
Well, I guess you were citing Zimmerman. You were responding to the question of what evidence there is that Zimmerman had animus against Olds because Olds whistleblew. I'm going to call it just whistleblew rather than say reports, because the report thing gets complicated. So he engaged in protected activity, right?
Right.
So. And you cited this thing from February 14th to show that Zimmerman had animus against him because of his protected activity. And I'm not quite following your description of what that is.
Okay, so that's one example of him taking absolutely no, of ignoring the report. But there was...
What's the report? His protected activity?
Yes.
Zimmerman ignored people taking adverse action against him because of his protected activity?
That, and he also says in the email that he has engaged in protected activity.
So we should look for the email from February 14, 2020, you're saying.
Right. And then... at page 5 of my brief, we talk about Zimmerman making the comment that Olds should feel defensive in a meeting with them regarding the content of the report. So on page 5, you'll see citations to the report that he makes, and then the Zimmerman email where he says Olds should feel defensive. And then the HR person refers to Troy Olds as the Troy Olds issue.
Okay.
So basically pages 4 and 5 talk about that whole circumstance of what it was that Olds was reporting and Zimmerman's and others' reaction to that, thinking that maybe he should be disciplined. And so if you look at those emails that are cited in the record, that'll be helpful.
I think I have just one more question, and it has to do with the issue of spoliation. I'm wondering what relevance it has at the summary judgment stage in light of the fact that the district court's sanctions order speaks specifically about jury instructions at trial. In other words, and I think you're not challenging the sanctions order. We take that as given, but given that the consequence that the district court chose was, I think, limited to trial, at least by its terms. I mean, just so is it even something that's relevant at the summary judgment stage?
Completely. A, the judge thought it was relevant. B, it's relevant because all adverse inferences, all inferences, have to be weighed in favor of the plaintiff. We know one of the inferences that a jury would look at is what happened to this evidence. How can we have a different standard at summary judgment that we would not have at trial? And so if this adverse inference is given, it has to be used at summary judgment. How can you destroy evidence, come to the court and say, oh, we don't see any evidence of causation, get an adverse inference, and avoid going to trial and suffer the consequences of that adverse inference? Rule 56 states that all inferences must be construed in favor of the plaintiff, and this is a key inference.
So I guess your argument would be, irrespective of the spoliation order an inference could be drawn by this if you proved up at summary judgment it was destroyed? I mean, is it dependent on the spoliation order? Maybe it is. I don't know.
Well, I think the spoliation order articulates what it is. I mean, if you look at other cases where they said spoliation doesn't matter, and if you look at those cases actually said because the court didn't find that there was a problem with it. And so you would distinguish it from those cases who say that spoliation doesn't matter by saying, in this case, the judge found that it did matter. It's a big deal. And we can articulate. We don't have to guess at what one of the inferences is. We know what one of the inferences is, and that has to go in the favor of the plaintiff.
What is that inference?
The jury may infer that the lost or deleted documents data which were under the exclusive control of defendant would have been favorable to plaintiff's claims and would have been unfavorable to defendant's defenses. And that includes all the emails of everyone.
It appears there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Culbert. Counsel for respondent. Please, at the beginning, identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Jessica Shui and counsel. I'm also here today with Attorney Jana O'Leary Sullivan. We represent the city of Moorhead, and we are requesting of this court that it reaffirm the decision of the lower court to grant summary judgment dismissal. There's been questions by this court as to where is this in the record and what should we be focusing on. What I would encourage the court to focus on based upon the case law that's before the court, is the testimony of the decision maker. Christina Volker is the city manager. Her deposition transcript is in the record, and she goes through various topics that was covered with appellant here a few moments ago, and we'll go through that here. And first, I want to focus on the February 14th, 2020 email. Christina Volker is asked about that. It's marked in her deposition or referred to in her deposition as Exhibit 54. There's a discussion about it at pages 28 to 29 of her deposition, and she states specifically she had never seen that email before, not even before her deposition. It was the first time that she was ever seeing it. So that email cannot serve as evidence of what was in her mind at the time that she made the decision to terminate. Okay. Then we go through, what does she know? I will agree that she testifies, and this is at pages 48 of her testimony, is the best discussion of it, that she relied on the oral conversation of Zimmerman, or that she had with Zimmerman about Troy Olds' conduct and on February 20th, 2020, and that she was relying on his credibility and accuracy in stating that Clay Lexon was left in fear based upon his conversation with Troy Olds, and that Zimmerman was very concerned about it and something needed to be done about it. Then she says, I relied on Michelle Soldo's report. Page 49, she says, I am and was the sole decision maker.
And did she also say she relied on a recommendation from HR? I think at 49.
At 49, the question was asked, and she said more specifically in the discussions with Zimmerman, is what she referred to there as opposed to Settergan. But we will recognize that she's taking into consideration, this goes to the unequal treatment conversation, is it effectively fair to terminate his employment based upon what occurred on February 20th, 2020? And she says, I'm concluding, effectively, it's fair. Now, I'll step back for a minute and say Minnesota case law is that a person may be terminated at will, which means for any reason, not unlawful.
So the report by Soldo is based on conversations with people.
Correct.
including Mr. Lexon?
Correct.
Mr. Austin?
Correct.
Olds, Mr. Olds?
Correct.
Et cetera. And do you agree that Mr. Olds, is there a dispute about what happened in that room with respect to Mr. Olds' conduct? And why isn't there a dispute? If he says, I wasn't angry, I wasn't barricading, and it's a little uncertain to me whether there's an admission about raised voices, but it seems that there is. So there were raised voices, but it was not out of the ordinary. So in other words, not a, quote, angry tirade?
Correct. Mr. Olds will not agree that it was a, quote, angry tirade, end of quote. He will agree that he comported himself in a way that Mr. Lexon likely had, quote, hurt feelings.
He said, if anything, it's because I hurt his feelings.
Thank you.
Right?
Yes.
I think that's what he said.
Yes.
So if there's a dispute about what happened, and even though there's a investigation that found it happened this way, isn't the fact, based on talking to people, not having observed it, isn't the fact that there's a dispute about what happened, doesn't that raise a question? And what happened is the reason for the termination. Why isn't that a reason to, that creates a genuine issue of material fact that sends us to trial about whether that reason is in fact pretextual?
So on that, Your Honor, we cited in our brief the case law that says we look at what's the reason advanced by the employer. That's it. You move on in the analysis then to the next step. Even if this court were to dig deeper in it, again, is this enough of a reason? And again, that's why I step back a moment and say this is an at-will state. This can terminate for any reason, not unlawful. The city could terminate him for merely hurting Clay Lexon's feelings that day. An undisputed fact. And I was trying, and intentionally in its appellate brief, the city was reducing it down to, we'll accept as true your version of events. We will reduce it, take it down to a watered-down version of what happened on February 20th. A one-hour-long conversation with Clay Lexon, where you spoke in a manner that caused hurt feelings. That is
how that he admits it caused hurt feelings. Is that a fair thing from that statement? I don't know. It seems like that it's like an angry tirade that caused fear in the workplace is a reason that they said they were. I mean, the rationale that was given for I'm terminating you seemed more than you hurt someone's feelings. Right?
That is exactly, that's very true.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it is true that, and this is discussed by Volkers, she did make the decision on the fact that in her mind, Soldo's report established that this was a sufficiently serious incident that caused fear in employee. Okay, caused fear. And so that's what's in the mind of her. And so she has that at pages. We have pages 46 to 47, and she discusses it at pages 54. So it is fair to say that was how she viewed the incident based upon the information that had been provided to her at Soldo's report. It's also fair to say that Olds says that's not what happened.
Okay. But your argument is even if she's wrong about that, that's not what in fact happened. Even if she's wrong, the fact that it didn't happen that way is not evidence that gets you the plaintiff to trial that it was motivated by something else.
Exactly, that it was motivated by what does he have to establish even to defeat summary judgment?
So
that it was some motivation related to retaliation. Yeah.
So then we get to the question I think it circles back to. Soldo's report is based on talking to people whom he had previously made reports of wrong. He had engaged in protected activity with.
Correct.
So why doesn't that get him there? If the basis for this report conduct, the report of the conduct is disputed and it's based on them, and he says, I have a history, there's a history that's in the record that I can at least go to trial on, that I was suffered retaliation because of their animus against me for my reports.
Okay.
Can you really cut it off and say, but Volker didn't know that? Or could have been wrong. I mean, you know, relied on it even though it was motivated by that.
So I can't completely cut it off.
Okay.
And I think that's helpful to go to that conversation. So she says, and this was one of the questions by one of your honors, and I'm sorry, I don't remember right now who it was. Did she know about all the conduct between 2015 and 2020? And she says that pages 8 to 9 and then 11 to 14. I'm sorry, 8 to 9 and then pages 11 and pages 14. I'm a city manager overseeing 275 to 300 employees. I don't know all of the details of these incidents. I didn't know that he was continuously making reports, I'll say whistleblowing reports, from 2015 to 2020. I didn't know that information. To go to your, and this is one of your questions earlier, Judge Smith, what did she know at the time that she's making, I'm going to say, the final termination decision? So she ends up testifying that at the time that I issued the notice of intent to terminate your employment, I knew what Zimmerman told me, Soldo's report, and then I'm giving him an opportunity to respond to it, and he says in response information that she did not previously know, which is that he was claiming that Ostergren had been creating an abusive environment, and specifically this conversation with the, I hate my effing job because of you. That's the first time that she learned of it. There's a series of questioning on it. This is about pages 101 to 103. It's also slightly discussed at pages 55 to 57. Was that information relevant to you when you're making your termination decision? And she says, no, it's not. And this goes to, in part, the comparator evidence analysis in the pretext argument in the case law that we talk about and cite in our brief. I'm learning of this the first time between the notice of intent and finalizing my decision. He's complaining about conduct that took place a year prior to that. It wasn't material, relevant, or probative to me on making my employment decision, so I proceeded to make the employment decision. She's saying that as a fact witness. It also happens to align with the case law. It's not probative. The fact that Austin said to him a year prior to to these incidences, I hate my effing job because of you, as she says, without context, what's the circumstances that were going on at the time? That's not enough to tell me that it's unfair to terminate you for the conduct that has been sustained in the Soldo investigation.
So even if he were able to come to trial, produce evidence that I reported wrongdoing to Austin, Austin responded to me, I hate my effing job because of you. And showing animus in response to his report of wrongdoing. The fact that Austin is later a source in the report that finds misconduct doesn't matter as long as a person who, like, relies on that report doesn't know about that animus. So if there's animus that truly is retaliatory animus, and that person is it's getting again into the theory, can you just say, as long as I didn't know about it and made a decision based on report that arguably was motivated, the people who supplied the information arguably was motivated, or can be at least a genuine issue as to whether it's motivated by retaliatory animus, that it doesn't matter. That it just seems problematic to me. It seems like if the report is wrong because it relied on people who had retaliatory animus, then it's a problem to terminate that person.
There's a couple of things I would say.
Okay.
First is, if Volkers did not know, case law says it's not in her mind and cannot serve as evidence of retaliatory animus, not in her mind, not a part of the decision-making process, right? Now, because it is in her mind, I'll say the final stage after the notice of intent, in her mind, what is in her mind that a year prior, someone else in a different situation, I don't know the full context, allegedly acted in a similar manner as you on February 20th and was treated differently. That's not evidence of retaliation. That's a discussion about whether there was differential treatment of two similarly situated employees. And the case law would say that is not comparator employees. It is not differential treatment of similarly situated employees because they're not similarly situated. The incidences are a year apart. We don't know the context of the 2019 one, or Volkers doesn't know the context of the 2019 incident as compared to the context of the 2020. I think that's, if you walk through that analysis, it resolves the problematic, what you're referring to being as problematic issues. And it's consistent with the case law on those concepts. Because I cannot dispute the fact that case law says, look, comparator evidence can push plaintiff into trial.
What's the case law you're referring to, and for what principle?
On the comparator evidence, Your Honor.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm asking what you're saying that the case law supports you, the argument that you're making. But I'm just wondering, can you cite cases, or what case are you referring to?
Yeah. So in our pretext analysis of our brief, we cite to the Hansen case and also the Hoover versus Northwest Banking case, and we say those are, it really, Hoover more specifically spells out at that time, considerably older case, what's the type of evidence that the court should be, and I use in our brief, rooting around in the record for to see if there's something here that suggests that this was a retaliatory termination.
I was going to ask whether you agree with Ms. Culberth that any discriminatory animus of other persons who had input into Volker's decision may be imputed into the company, or to the city.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
So I will take it a step further, Your Honor. You asked the question about whether Minnesota has adopted the cat's paw theory. I don't know. I can't think of a case right now, a Minnesota state court case that's adopted the cat's paw theory. That being said, we frequently look to the federal decisions on that, and more likely than not, Minnesota case law would adopt cat's paw, and it's something that employment lawyers use in litigation. We talk about that. So do I necessarily disagree with the argument? No. If there was something that...
Potentially relevant that, you know, in other words, so our inquiry into retaliatory animus should include then perhaps Soldo, Zimmerman, and Settergren.
I completely agree with that, yes. It potentially could. It's not here in this record. As Your Honor asked the question, I see my time is out. May I have a
Please
minute
continue.
To respond?
Yeah.
Okay. As Your Honor asked, what's the evidence of, and I'll start with Soldo, what's the evidence of retaliatory sentiment by Soldo? I didn't hear a response to that. I'm not aware of anything in the record that would suggest that Investigator Soldo had a retaliatory animus against Mr. Olds. With regard to Mr. Zimmerman, is there anything that would evidence retaliatory animus? We don't have any discriminatory remarks. All we have is, I'll say, a lack of action by him. That's not, when we're doing this analysis, we're looking for affirmative events. We're not, as I use in the language in the brief, you can't just paper over this ultimate moving burden that it's evidencing retaliation by saying, well, he didn't do anything in response to this February 14th, 2020 email. Okay, and then we go on to Amy Settergren. I think the important component about Amy Settergren is reviewing closely Volker's deposition testimony, and this is even true with Zimmerman. What is she talking to them about, and what is she relying on? With Zimmerman, she's testifying to what's going into my mind and what I'm relying on is he came to me 2 days after the incident and said, this incident happened, Clalexin is in fear, I think it's a serious incident, we need to do something about it. That's what she's relying on. There's nothing about that that evinces retaliatory intent. Similar to Amy Settergren, what are we doing here in terms of scheduling the investigation? What are we doing here in terms of scheduling his opportunities to do a response? He's represented by a union attorney at this point in time. There's a lot of back and forth giving him an opportunity to respond to the outcome of the investigation and say, why should you not be terminated for your conduct on February 20th? That, too, does not evince retaliatory sentiment. If anything, it evinces that the city is trying to give him an opportunity to justify conduct that the case law says it doesn't have to tolerate. It does not have to tolerate an angry tirade or even a person that communicates with the employees in another way that hurts the feelings of others.
So we went down one level, Volker's, then to those three sources.
Yes.
For all of them, all of those people, HR and the independent investigator, Zimmerman different, okay, because it's like he's right a manager there, right, or the head of the department. But for the others, now you have to go down a level further for the basis of their information that Lexin was afraid, that the behavior was bad, et cetera. And so now we're talking Lexin and Austin and the people right around. Where is there what happens if there is evidence to create a genuine dispute of material fact, namely that reports are made to them that constitute protected activity and they treated him poorly because of that? They retaliated.
Mm-hmm.
So now we go down a level. Do you disagree under the cat's paw theory that can be? I mean, do you cut it off at first level?
You cut it off at some point, and I'm going to use kind of the Falls graph analysis of going back to law school. How far down the chain do you go? I think the employment case law is clear. You go as far down the chain as what got into Ms. Volker's mind.
So it doesn't seem that far to go to the people who experienced the event that's at issue. That's the reason for the termination, to say, let's look at those people. Is that too far to go
to see whether they have animus? I think it definitely is too far to go here, and it's definitely too far to go based upon the decision maker's own testimony.
Why is it too far to go for the imputed knowledge to go to the people who actually are saying, hey, here's... And that becomes the ultimate reason.
Hey, what's happened, as long as it's in the Solo report, which she testified I read every page of it.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not in the Solo's report, that's unfair to go beyond that.
But Soldo said, I talked to Austin, I talked to Lexin, and here's what
I found. And provides summaries, mm-hmm. right? I think any one of us can say right now, we in our brain, we have a certain amount of information. You can only rely on what I'm telling you right now. You can't be held responsible for things that I'm not telling you or I didn't put in front of you. This court is limited to the summary judgment record. I can't put in new things now. So Volker's and being held liable for a retaliatory decision, allegedly, can only be held liable to the extent something was actually in her mind put to her. It would be inappropriate to allow introduction of things coming from all these different witnesses that was not in her mind at the time.
So no imputed knowledge? Or is that a different question?
I'm going to agree that there's some level of imputed knowledge.
Okay.
It's because of what there's imputed. It's imputed in the sense that what did she rely on? Mm-hmm. Everything that's in Soldo's report, because she said I read every page. What she says Zimmerman told her, and what she said she was discussing with Settergren as they're going back between those notes of intent to terminate and the finalization of that decision. Your Honors, I'm well beyond my time. Are there any further questions?
I have one more question about the law, and I think maybe 10 minutes ago you were talking about case law, I think, in response to some questions from Judge Smith. I think what you are referring to is what I might call the honest belief case law or the honest belief doctrine, where if the decision maker honestly believes certain facts on which a non-discriminatory decision is made, but if those facts turn out to be incorrect, it's nonetheless true that the decision is not, or at least might not be deemed discriminatory or retaliatory, you know, for an innocent mistake or an honest incorrect belief.
Yes.
Is that what you were referring to? And I guess, and if so, I would first go, is that what you're talking about?
I would say I didn't specifically refer to that, but I would agree with that, Your Honor. And to the extent the court is looking for the most recent discussion by the Court of Appeals on that would be Sackerson versus City of, oh, it's up north. Sorry, I don't remember the name of the city right now. Sackerson is Sakrison. And the arguments were very similar to what's being argued here and what was in the mind of the decision maker at the time of making the decision. And even if it was erroneous, the fact of the matter is that was what was in their mind and what served as the basis for the decision.
And the question I was thank you for that. The question I was working up to is whether if the cat's paw theory or something like it is applies, doesn't that have the potential to sort of carve out something from the so-called honest belief case law? In other words, you know, I mean, if a decision maker honestly believes certain facts because she's influenced by other persons who have a discriminatory animus, then discrimination is at work.
Right.
And I don't know if there's any case law that says that, but that seems logical to me. And I'm wondering if you can provide any input on that for us.
Right. So I'm gonna say a couple of things on that. The employment lawyer juices are flowing, and there's a lot of things I would say on it, which then reminds me we didn't brief that. Neither party did. So if this court is inclined to have a discussion on honest belief, cat's paw, how far those go, what the test would be, there should be an order for further briefing to the parties. Because
that wasn't addressed by the trial court either. I mean,
because that argument hasn't.
What I'm getting at is supplemental briefing, we'd be taking something out for the trial court to have the first analysis of. If you're suggesting supplemental briefing.
On that, though, Your Honor, I do think the court could do that because this is at this level, because you're doing de novo review. And so the court could take up these legal principles and order us to brief on it and then say, okay, we're on the fact record. Then what's the correct legal outcome based upon this record that's before us? So I would request that there be further briefing. If the court's going to reach an analysis on cat's paw and the extent to which it's applicable here, as well as honest belief, there probably should be further briefing on it. That being said, I'm going to stick with the arguments that I've made, which is consistent with the briefing already in front of this court. We look at the mind, what's the information before Volkers at the time that she made her decision on the notice of intent to terminate, and then riding through the time frame where she finalizes that decision after he's given an opportunity to refute it.
Judge Johnson, do you mind if I ask one more question?
No, I do not mind.
Sorry, I know we went over, so I don't think it's so unfair, although I may be bombarding. I don't think we asked you anything about spoliation and what impact spoliation should have relative to, on summary judgment here, and relative to providing inferences that are against you here.
Right, Your Honor. So on that, as we briefed, the fact that a spoliation inference was given, an adverse inference was given as part of a spoliation sanction, does not defeat summary judgment here. We cited the Foss case on that and said it's not material to resolution of the issues that are before the court. in part because on appeal, we're not challenging the prima facie case. And what we're saying is there sufficient evidence of a retaliatory motive, the sufficient showing
but
to...
But his showing could be arguably in emails that got disclosed. I mean, I don't even know. That case I looked at, it did seem more that there. I don't even know if there was a finding of spoliation. But let's say here on summary judgment, they just prove up that they destroyed, wrongly destroyed emails, et cetera. Can't the district court take an inference from that? Should it take an inference that there's something in there that's adverse to your case? What makes it limited to the prima facie case? Why can't it be an inference on whether there simply is evidence of a discriminatory or a retaliatory motive, which is the end question here?
What I would say, Your Honor, is that there is still the testimony by Volkers of what she was relying on. She was very specific on it was the Soldo report, the oral communication with Bob Zimmerman, and then this timing with Settergren going after the notice of intent to terminate and the finalization of that decision. With that, Your Honor, I would say that there is not enough in this record to give that showing.
But now I have a question, Judge Johnson. Thank you. The court in its spoliation order said, while the court generally believes that this was negligence by the city and not a purposeful intention to delete evidence, it was nevertheless deleted. On the spoliation issue, would there not be a need to have a finding by the court that there was some maliciousness or intent or deliberate undertaking by the city to do this? Wouldn't that be a part of, I'm trying to help your argument, wouldn't that be a part of it?
It would, Your Honor. It would. If we're back in trial court, we're remanded back to try this case, I'm confident that there'll be more arguments over whether that spoliation order should stand based upon a negligence finding. And whether that adverse instruction should go to the jury, and then what the language of that adverse instruction should be, which goes in part to the question that was asked by Judge Johnson. Is it of probative value at this time on summary judgment? Isn't it too premature? It is too premature in that sense because the negligence does remove the fact or undermines the fact. There shouldn't be an adverse instruction. That's not appropriate sanction if it was only negligence. The only other thing I would offer the courts on this point, there's a recent Eighth Circuit case. It's called Vogt versus Crow Wing County. It's a case I litigated. The United States Supreme Court just denied review. It is not an employment case, but there was a spoliation sanction given, similar in nature to this one here. And summary judgment was granted notwithstanding, and the Eighth Circuit engages in a conversation about whether that is a proper application, including under Rule 56 when there's a spoliation. That Eighth Circuit case does discuss other circuit decisions taking up those issues. I did not cite that case in the briefing here. It was not finalized at the time. The Supreme Court just denied review 2 weeks ago. The arguments are the same that I made there, and I believe that they are properly before this court on Minnesota state case law.
What's the name?
The Eighth Circuit case is Vogt, V-O-G-T, versus Crow Wing County.
Thank you.
Okay.
It appears there are no further questions. Ms. Shui, your suggestion about supplemental briefing will be considered. I'll say, speaking only for myself, that I do not think the court would expand upon the issues or arguments made. I think it's simply a question about whether the issues and arguments already raised could be explored or briefed in more detail, perhaps a deeper dive into some of those issues. And you know, I think that probably would be the nature of the court's discussion. But so I appreciate we would I think, generally not expand upon the arguments already raised by the parties.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate your remarks. As it stands today, I'll simply request that summary judgment dismissal be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shui. Ms. Culberth, you have an opportunity for rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. First off, I wanted to hit the question that you had about imputed notice and whether or not we had case law on that. It's the Metcalf versus Allina Health Systems case, 2021 Westlaw 4059660. I believe it's cited in the materials. It's citing a Dietrich case, and it says that an agent's actual notice of the facts may be imputed to the principal. Again, the court found that the argument about whether or not she had notice of the retaliatory conduct was unpersuasive. That should not be at issue before this court. The only thing that should be at issue for this court is whether or not the court weighed evidence in making the determination that summary judgment should be granted. And the answer to that is yes. And it's because the court already found that the elements of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act had been met, and then considered the defendant's alternate explanation as to why the case should be dismissed, and then put the burden of persuasion back onto the plaintiff at summary judgment. In the case law that we have cited, say, this is not consistent with Rule 56, this is not consistent with the summary judgment standard that has been articulated by the Supreme Court, and it is not consistent with McGrath that says that all we have to do to show causation is that it was a motivating factor. Now, we have showed that it is a motivating factor, and I will give you this is an answer to a question that Judge Johnson had asked me before, and I think I got halfway through it, and I would like to supplement that answer. And that is, what additional evidence of causation is there? We have direct evidence of retaliatory animus. Now, I'd like to correct something. There's been some contention that when Austin yells at Oles and told him that he hated his job, that happened a year prior. Not true. That happened on November 1st, 2019. So it shows a high degree of animosity towards Oles related to engaging in protected conduct. And if you look at the Tamburino case, in addition to circumstantial evidence supporting her prima facie case, including her supervisor viewed her as insubordinate for engaging in protected conduct, plaintiff's evidence of a fact dispute over whether a job had been created for plaintiff, and her supervisor describing plaintiff as having a toxic presence creates a tribal issue on causation. The city engaged in a pattern of retaliatory actions after each report over a course of years. The record is replete with every time he makes a report, he gets in, he has some sort of an adverse action happen. That pattern is evidence of causation. There was evidence of a plan to fire Oles. After Oles engaged in protected conduct, Austin starts papering the file on Oles, which he admits he did not do for other people.
I don't understand what that meant.
Okay.
You're talking about papering the file before February 20th, 2020?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he started papering the file. I can go back and look at the dates, but I think maybe it was 2017, 2018.
And that comes out of the personnel file?
That is in the Austin deposition.
Austin deposition.
And there are notes. And he says, I took notes on Troy Oles and started keeping notes of his behavior. Did you do that with anyone else? No. So there is... there's evidence that Lexon had retaliatory animus. Because remember, it's Olds reported that Lexon was trying to delete maps that showed survey information was incorrect. We talked about the differential treatment for workplace tirades. Hoover supports that that is evidence of causation.
The differential treatment, though, if they had different supervisors, if Volkers didn't know about it.
They both went to Human Resources. He complains to Human Resources about what Austin did. She does nothing. When it goes to Human Resources about what happened with Lexan, they have an outside investigator come in.
So
it's a completely different
the
treatment.
Differential treatment to Settergren's response.
Exactly, which is imputed to the employer. So, again, this idea about causing fear. If it's important that there was fear caused in Lexan, why is it important that there was fear caused with Troy Olds? Troy Olds told his employer that because of the way that Austin treated him, he ended up in a stairwell crying for half an hour. But the fear and the angst that's caused to Troy Olds somehow doesn't matter. With respect to spoliation, I'm sorry, my time is up, but I did want to cover spoliation if I could.
Briefly.
Okay. So with respect to spoliation, the Foss case that was cited by the defendant should be looked at because that, and I have this in my reply brief, the case did not involve a court-ordered sanction. And so it is important, and we need to look at the fact that this is a court-ordered spoliation instruction. I thank the Your Honors for giving us the extra time that we took today. This is a very important issue. Whistleblowers need to be protected, and their reports need to be protected. And the jury right is an integral foundation to our democracy and a constitutional right for Mr. Olds. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Culberth. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments, both in writing and orally. Especially for your knowledge of the record. Case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. And so with that, we are adjourned.